thought. And having spoken to her over the course of months, he'd acquired a sense of the direction she wanted to go in. Hillary thought she needed a more professional staff and cleaner lines of authority than she'd had in 2008. That, in theory, would reduce the infighting that had plagued her first bid. There were a lot of differences between the two finalists for the job, but two stuck out. First, O'Malley Dillon preferred a big, formal staff with a strong leadership structure, like what she'd helped build for Obama. But Mook thought those campaigns were too top-heavy. Having worked with Hillary in 2008 and Obama after that, his favored structure, with power streamlined toward him, was something of a hybrid. Second, Mook was a data analytics disciple who decided where to hire staff, send the candidate, and pay for ads based on the information number crunchers gave him about voters. He saw the modern tools as effective and cost-effective. It was a lot less expensive for data experts to collect and analyze information provided by voters than it was for pollsters to conduct extensive opinion research. If the models were built right and the inputs were accurate, data analytics could also save money by more efficiently targeting voters who were likely to show up and support the campaign's candidate. Best of all, he could cite the data reports as evidence to back up his decisions. O'Malley Dillon, on the other hand, saw data analytics as an important tool, but not the only one. Ultimately, Mook's approach better suited both Hillary's belief in evidence and, after having spent millions on her campaign in 2008, her desire to keep costs down. Hillary liked O'Malley Dillon and wanted her in the fold. But she'd already gone a long way with Mook, and she decided to stick with him. At that point, it would have meant taking away someone who had been building things, said one source familiar with Hillary's vetting, who said she made the right choice. Mook's 2010 instinct to clean house at the DCCC had only been sharpened. Behind the scenes, according to people familiar with his moves, he worked to neutralize potential power rivals in a variety of ways. For example, knowing that Hillary wanted O'Malley Dillon involved with the campaign, he put her on retainer and brought her in to work on a series of projects, including early planning for the general election. But she would never have an official role. And talk of her taking over as the top executive at the Democratic National Committee never materialized. Robbie boxed her out, said one campaign official. Mook liked to be the only one with a full view of the campaign's arms, from budgeting to polling, data analytics, and field organizing. I didn't work with counterparts in some departments, said one campaign official. The way that Robbie operated was, and this is not a criticism, a real hub-and-spokes kind of manager. But that structure, in which Mook had the only full view, would become a persistent point of contention for some veterans of Hillary land and senior officials on the campaign. Mook's obsession with control served him well, but colleagues saw his self-interest coming at the cost of the candidate. He had already begun to develop a reputation for caring as much about his own brand and promoting his own people as he did about getting Hillary elected. In the media, his allies had made sure his job in McAuliffe's campaign was portrayed as a dress rehearsal for managing Hillary's 2016 operation. His organizing ability, aspirational nature, and understanding of how to build loyalty helped him nurture a cult-like power base within a campaign and in certain Democratic circles. In the words of one Democratic insider who knows Mook well, he had a desire to maintain the kingdom rather than win the war. For the most part, he favored people he'd worked with, the Mook Mafia, to fill the upper ranks of the campaign team. The set of allies he hired from past campaigns he'd worked on included Marlon Marshall, Elon Kriegel, and Michael Halley, as well as Orrin Schur, who had bought ads for the Democratic Governors Association the year McAuliffe won in Virginia. Mook had tried to set himself up to hold all the keys to Hillary's operation. Yet right from the start, a threat to his vision of total control already existed in the form of a scrappy grassroots super PAC called Ready for Hillary. And not even the expressed wishes of Bill and Hillary Clinton could keep Mook from crushing it. For over 2 years, inside a fifth-floor suite on North Kent Street in the dress shirt and slacks Washington suburb of Rosslyn, Virginia, the 30 staffers of the Ready for Hillary super PAC had worked to lure Hillary into the presidential race. They built a list they boasted had 3 million Hillary supporters, identified nearly 200,000 donors, and raised $15 million to lay a foundation for the Clinton campaign and give Hillary a much-needed head start. Derided by some Clinton insiders and the media as a bunch of self-seeking amateurs, particularly in the beginning, when one Clintonite joked with another that they should start a rival super PAC called Geeked Up for Hillary, the small staff of Ready for Hillary actually had strong ties to the Clintons' inner circle. The ringleader of the group, Adam Parkamenko, a shaved, bald, part-time reserve Washington cop, stood out for his slavish devotion to Hillary and a raw energy notable even in the adrenaline junkie world of American campaign politics. Parkamenko had worked for Clinton's first 2008 campaign manager, Patty Solis Doyle, and later in the office of Capricia Marshall, who handled politically sensitive tasks like fighting for delegates after it was clear Obama would win the primary. When the first campaign was over, he organized a dead-end effort to pressure Obama to put Clinton on the ticket. By the time he was 30, he had spent more than a decade obsessed by the singular goal of pushing Hillary Clinton back into the White House. Whatever strange brew led Parkamenko to focus his entire life on Hillary's ascent, it was intoxicating enough to her inner circle that his RFH effort, co-headlined by career activist Alida Black, won more than a tacit blessing from the highest ranks of the Clinton machine as he began ramping it up in 2013. While many Clintonites were initially skeptical of the super PAC, Parkamenko eventually won most of them over by proving that he wasn't just tapping into small-dollar donors, but was also securing big-league names like financier and philanthropist Warren Buffett. Knowing that Buffett was big on seeing a return on his investments, Parkamenko and his staff wrote an old-fashioned letter to the investor and discussed their own success with digital and online advertising. They told him that while he wouldn't get a financial return on his investment, he would reap rewards for his candidate. 6 days later, Buffett sent a response, along with a $25,000 check and an admonition to verify that the donation was legal by Federal Election Commission standards. He was all in for Clinton, he said, adding that Ready for Hillary was the first outside group he was going to support. As long as you can promise I'm not doing anything illegal under the FEC limits, you may cash this $25,000 check, he wrote in ink on the typed letter. Because of Clinton's abiding loyalty, and because Ready for Hillary had made significant donor and volunteer contacts, the assumption among Hillary watchers was that the super PAC would be absorbed into the official presidential campaign when it launched. But as Mook began to quietly construct the apparatus for 2016, he took a dim view of RFH's future in his operation. In his view, shared by other professionals on the campaign, Ready for Hillary had grossly over-exaggerated the group's lists. After accounting for bad email addresses, one official later groused, it wasn't 500,000 names. Slowly, a tension began to build about how, or even whether, to incorporate Parkamenko's staff, his legions of grassroots supporters around the country, and the small donor base he'd built from nothing. That friction, known only to a small set of Clinton's most trusted advisors, was bubbling beneath the surface when Hillary convened a pre-holiday planning meeting in 2014, 4 months before she would release the video announcing her campaign. And she was concerned enough about the resolution of the Ready for Hillary question that she made sure her top aides could all hear, loud and clear, what she wanted done about it. "How many staff are there?" she asked. "How many work for Ready for Hillary?" "About 30, one of her aides replied. "Every single one of them gets a job on my campaign," Hillary decreed. There was good reason for Hillary to be concerned about keeping Parkamenko and his team involved. From its start in 2013, Ready for Hillary seemed to inspire and harness a certain spark and spunk Clinton lacked during her first presidential run. It wasn't quite the excitement generated by Barack Obama's Hope and Change tour, but Ready for Hillary built grassroots enthusiasm for a candidate whose natural cautiousness militated against inciting the masses. More than anything, it gave Clinton a network across the states. At its core, the battle over Ready for Hillary was a war between the mercenaries and the missionaries. In one corner stood Mook, a professional political assassin, regarded as an expert in organizing and managing a campaign who could earn his place on the list of great political operatives by electing Hillary president. Parkamenko, an alpha male in his own way, was the missionary, an amateur organizer and professional activist who would have thrown himself from a rooftop if he thought it would secure the presidency for Hillary. Both archetypes were familiar in Clinton world. The cold-eyed, self-serving strategists who built up themselves by building up one Clinton or both, and the sycophants who prove their loyalty to a Clinton by devoting their entire lives to the family. Hillary wanted them to coexist, but Mook did not. In the early days of the campaign, and for months before the launch, Mook seldom missed an opportunity to rip Parkamenko and his squad. Throughout 2014, he griped to Mills that RFH would unnecessarily complicate the campaign's work and create legal headaches. Mills was unimpressed and questioned whether Mook's objections were valid. When Mook found out that RFH was reaching out to Obama's Iowa precinct captains to secure their support for Hillary in January 2015, he fumed to Podesta in an email, "This goes in my category of things that should really be left to the campaign. This could damage politics." In the end, RFH's staff continued to organize for Hillary in the early states, and the precinct captains they signed up in Iowa would prove a crucial force in the caucuses there. Knowing Hillary wanted to bring in the RFH crew, Podesta assigned Parkamenko and Craig Smith, a former aide to Bill Clinton and senior advisor to the Super PAC, to produce a memo listing the set of Ready for Hillary staffers, their titles, which positions on the campaign they wanted, and the posts for which they would actually be qualified. Parkamenko drew up the memo, and it was delivered to Podesta. Ready for Hillary aides were ecstatic about the new jobs they were going to get on the Clinton campaign. Not only had Hillary declared her desire to hire them, but Podesta also gave verbal assurances to Smith and Parkamenko that the RFH staff would be brought on board. "There will be no gaps in your paychecks," Podesta said. The RFH upstarts began looking at apartments in Brooklyn. Parkamenko told his team members that they would each get a call from a hiring authority on the campaign. It might not be for the job at the top of their wish list, but they would be taken care of. But for many, their phones never rang. They obsessively refreshed their email inboxes and found nothing from top campaign staffers. There were no texts from Hillary for America. The Parkamenko-Smith memo found its way into the circular file at the Clinton campaign headquarters. That's not to say no one from Ready for Hillary got a job on the campaign. Months later, when reporters started asking questions about Ready for Hillary staffers who hadn't been hired, Hillary again asked about them at a meeting with Mook and Marlon Marshall. They assured her the RFH crew was being taken care of. Then, on April 1, 2015, the campaign hastily announced that Parkhomenko and several others had been added to the payroll. He was given the title of Director of Grassroots Engagement, but in his new job on the inside, he had a very small team and virtually no budget. Mook had neutralized him. Smith emailed Podesta on April 10th to complain about the situation. "Just so you know, as of today, six of our people have been given jobs," Smith wrote. "Today I have to lay off 17 people." Podesta tried to placate him. "Doubt that is a permanent condition, but let me know details of the people left out." It was hardly a promise to take up arms in defense of RFH. It seemed like a no-brainer for Clinton's campaign to tap into the state-by-state network that Parkhomenko had built to serve it. The group's lists had value, and lawyers for Ready for Hillary and the Clinton campaign would spend weeks planning how they could legally transfer all the data from the super PAC to the campaign. In addition to Hillary, there was one other force in Clinton world that had a soft spot for Parkhomenko and his crack unit of organizers: Bill Clinton. "Whose bright idea was it to shut down Ready for Hillary?" he repeatedly asked Smith, knowing full well that it was Mook's. But Mook, never a fan of Ready for Hillary, and certainly in no mood to empower another organizer in his own campaign headquarters, sent a clear signal that RFH wasn't really welcome in Brooklyn or anywhere else the campaign operated. Knowing Hillary's concern for RFH, Mook would later acknowledge that the lists compiled by the group were helpful, but he viewed the personnel as a nuisance at best and a threat at worst. There was no room in his kingdom for the princes of the defunct super PAC. Once he'd extracted the group's lists, which he thought had limited value, they were done. As one Democratic insider familiar with Mook's thinking put it, "When you're done with a condom, you throw it out." Parkhomenko proved easy enough for Mook to topple, but there were more perilous fault lines running through the campaign and the larger Clinton world maw. It was nearly impossible, if not impossible, to grab hold of all the various independent actors who had access to Hillary. Podesta, Abedin, Palmieri, Sullivan, and others within the campaign had direct lines to her. So did any number of advisors, donors, and friends. On matters pertaining to her private server issue, she had a team of lawyers whose need to protect her did not necessarily line up with the best political strategies for the campaign. And of course, Bill Clinton and Chelsea Clinton influenced the candidate. The map of Clinton world looked like a traffic jam on a Venn diagram, with so many interlocking and concentric circles that it was next to impossible to determine who was in Hillary's ear. Try as he did, Mook would never be able to exert full control. In fact, early tangles demonstrated the limits of his domain. Mook, who thought Podesta wasn't present enough, would sometimes make decisions without consulting him. That infuriated Podesta. In theory, they were supposed to work in tandem, with Podesta keeping in touch with Democratic elites, guiding messaging and troubleshooting, while Mook tended to the mechanics of the campaign. But their lines of authority were never that clear, and Hillary's intimates could influence her on any particular issue at any moment. She had set up rival power centers everywhere, and no one had enough authority to make the others play nice. Nor was anyone empowered to both enforce Hillary's will and tell her when she was wrong without fear of reprisal. Several Clinton insiders said at the time that it was unclear who was really running the campaign. To the extent anyone was truly in charge, it was Hillary. But aides and advisors often pointed to Abedin as the staff member who influenced Hillary the most, despite her inexperience as a campaign operative. As she had at State, Abedin concerned herself with elements of the operation for which she had no credentials. But she had a corner on the most valuable commodity of any presidential campaign, the candidate's time. Abedin was with Hillary around the clock. She had the final say on where Hillary went and who had access to her. Rather than just being a gatekeeper, Abedin took on the role of channeling Hillary for the rest of the campaign. That created internal resentment, as it had at the State Department. Besides, Clinton aides groused, Abedin was a walking political time bomb. Her husband, former Congressman Anthony Weiner, had quit the House after sending sexually explicit tweets to women, and then lost a mayoral bid after revealing he hadn't stopped sexting women he'd met online. And that was just the screaming tabloid headline aspect of Abedin's potential for inflicting damage on the campaign. She had emailed the former Secretary of State as much as anyone through the private server. Some of the messages contained information that was later deemed to be classified. Abedin was a subject of interest for the House Benghazi Committee and, separately, for Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. He was investigating the work she'd done for Teneo, an international consulting firm founded by Bill Clinton's longtime consigliere Doug Band, when she was on the State Department payroll. Grassley thought that was a major conflict of interest, and even some of Hillary's advisors privately agreed. Having Abedin serve as Hillary's traveling aide was one thing, but giving her the title of vice chair and allowing her to expand her portfolio into major campaign decisions made little sense. But Abedin's defenders, and they were legion, often said she got a bad rap for closing Hillary off. In a campaign in which no strategist could really translate the candidate, no one had a better feel for Hillary or could act as the all-important go-between on the ground for the sprawling Clinton world. That made her indispensable to both the candidate and the rest of the team, her supporters pointed out. But many feared speaking their minds around her. She couldn't be counted on to relay constructive criticism to Hillary without pointing a finger at the critic. If Hillary was a candidate often isolated from her formal campaign, and she was, Abedin was the crock-filled moat encircling her. The royal Huma guard made it harder for Hillary's senior and mid-level aides to get time with the candidate, and that made it impossible to really know the woman they were selling. She's incredibly protective to a fault, said one Clinton ally. If I was running for president, I would want my staff to be able to reach me. If you can't reach her, then Hillary becomes cardboard Hillary. You've never spent time with her. She never really knows what you do. Mook tried and failed to limit Abedin's power in January 2015, just as the wheels of the campaign had begun to turn. Abedin was lining up a role in which she would have the title of vice chair, proximity to Hillary, and control over the candidate's schedule. In a memo to Podesta, Mook asked for input on how much we'd want her to still participate in scheduling if she does the HQ job. Abedin, he said, would be valuable in providing institutional memory on phone calls and in meetings, but I don't want people confused about who is in charge, i.e., the scheduler needs to be in command of that process. When Podesta didn't respond for 4 days, Mook resent the message. Abedin would get everything she wanted, and there should have been no confusion on Mook's part. Neither he nor anyone else could put Abedin in a corner. Okay, Mook thought after failing to gain traction. That's done. He would remain wary enough of Abedin that when he disagreed with her and told Hillary about it, he would then call Abedin to let her know, so that she didn't think he was going behind her back. Mook also clashed with Palmieri, a Podesta protege, in the early months of the campaign. In one briefing for campaign surrogates in Washington in the summer of 2015, Palmieri led off with a review of the messaging strategy. When she was done, she turned to Mook. "Robbie can give an update on the organizing strategy," she said, "because that's his domain." People in the room were taken aback. In theory, wasn't everything in the campaign manager's domain? But Palmieri had tremendous autonomy as the chief communications officer. And as a former White House communications director, she had reason to believe her acumen was far superior to Mook's when it came to the strategy and tactics of talking to the media. But in a relatively public fashion, she had asserted herself as his equal and appeared to demean him in the process. Another wing of the sprawling apparatus was centered at the Clinton Foundation. Hillary paid Bill's top aides when they worked on campaign matters. The former president himself represented one of the trickiest political thickets for Hillary. He was her closest advisor, and yet his off-the-cuff remarks on the campaign trail had inflicted serious damage in 2008. After that year's primary, Bill had given just as much support as was required to help unify the party. In 2012, he had reemerged as a force for Obama's reelection bid. But the Bill question always was more fraught for Hillary. He could be her strongest validator and at the same time overshadow her on the campaign trail or, as a result of his personal emotional investment in her success, go off half-cocked and dominate a news cycle with negative headlines. As the campaign staff would soon find out, it was virtually impossible to keep Bill out of the news, especially when Democrats started publicly second-guessing his legacy on topics ranging from criminal justice to gay rights. His desire to help Hillary win and his defense of his own legacy would be in constant conflict throughout the campaign. And the specter of his extramarital sexual activity and Hillary's response to it would become a major theme of the Republican strategy to defeat her. Inside the campaign, a bonfire of the vanities raged. Each division had its own silo. Mook in charge of the budget and operations, Palmieri at the helm of a sprawling and warring communications staff, Abedin in charge of Hillary, Sullivan guiding policy, and Elon Kriegel running the powerful analytics team. There was also a holy trinity of consultants who competed with Mook for influence. Chief strategist Benenson, ad man Margolis, and longtime Clinton message guru Grunwald. Podesta floated outside the structure. Some of Hillary's advisors thought she'd aligned her roster the wrong way. "She has too many people in jobs who should not be doing the jobs they're doing," one of them said. Much of this infighting might have been avoided had someone been given the authority to have the final say on matters large and small. But Hillary distributed power so broadly that none of her aides or advisors had control of the whole apparatus. Chapter 3. Feeling the Burn. In April 2014, Bernie Sanders called liberal radio talk show host Bill Press to his Senate office for lunch. Both men, like many white liberals, had started with great hopes for Obama's presidency, but had grown disappointed. After watching the president come up short of implementing a full progressive agenda, Bernie couldn't stand the idea of Hillary pulling the country back into the Clinton White House years. She was centrist and transactional, exactly the wrong direction, he thought. His feelings about her, which were less than positive, revolved around policy differences and revolved around her allegiance to an old form of campaigning relying on big money and the people who raise it for you, said one Sanders confidant who spoke to him around the same time. This kind of campaigning, of going to rich people and asking them for money and modulating your policies in a way that didn't inspire people, that was a losing formula. In terms of him not liking stuff about her, that's what he disliked the most. He wanted someone to run at her from the left, either to beat her or force her into taking more liberal positions. But no one had stepped up yet, not even the lion of the new left, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. If there's nobody else, Bernie kept thinking, maybe it ought to be me. Press had heard Sanders was considering a bid, and as they sat down to eat, he asked whether it was true. Yeah, I've been thinking, Bernie replied. I want to make sure that the progressive issues are front and center in the 2016 campaign. Hillary's not going to raise them on her own. Somebody's got to do it. Bernie never said as much, but the unspoken condition of his candidacy was the absence of Warren. If she ran, Press knew, Bernie wouldn't. Still, the thought of a true progressive running in 2016 was as exhilarating as the idea of a Clinton coronation was uninspiring. But Press had one major concern. He didn't think Hillary was just like the Republicans. He wanted a Democrat to win the presidency, and he worried that Bernie might run as a third-party candidate, siphon votes from the Democratic nominee, and hand the White House to the GOP. "You know, you're an independent," Press said. "To me, that's a problem, because if you run as an independent..." "No, no, no," Sanders assured him. "I would never be a Ralph Nader. I would never do anything to hurt a Democrat's chances of winning the White House." Where Sanders drew that particular line, and whether he would actually help the eventual Democratic nominee, were questions that would, much later, create knuckle-whitening angst within the party. Press was intrigued and offered a measure of encouragement to Bernie. "You know, if you are really seriously thinking about that, you should get people together who have been involved in presidential campaigns and just get their reaction," Press counseled. "Tell them what you're thinking of, and people who've done this might tell you if it's even doable." "That's a good idea," said Bernie, who was one step ahead of Press. "Would you organize that for me?" It would have been tough to dream up a caricature of a candidate so unlikely to catch fire in a presidential race. For starters, Bernie was already 72 years old, nearly 3 years beyond the age Ronald Reagan was when he became the oldest president inaugurated for the first time in 1981. Though he had been elected to the Senate twice and the House 8 times before that, he had always run as an independent, as a man without a party in a capital city in which only Republicans and Democrats wielded real power. He openly identified with socialism, an ideology to which few Americans subscribed. And he was disheveled enough, in a beat-up blue blazer with wild strands of white hair encircling his balding pate, that he could easily be mistaken in the Capitol for a lost scientist. Inside the Washington bubble, Bernie had long been looked at as a revolutionary without much of a following. He'd had some success in writing amendments that brought the left and right wings of the two parties together, and the Senate had proved a much better venue for his brand of politics than the House had. But his list of real legislative accomplishments was short and relatively undistinguished. He didn't slap backs or cut deals. Over the years, he'd railed against presidents of both parties, which had a tendency to limit his influence. And yet, as perhaps the most reliably liberal voice in Congress, he had built a following among progressives who caught clips of him on C-SPAN. The uncompromising and incorruptible style that made him a failure at the inside game of Washington was precisely the reason he was poised to take advantage of a populist renaissance in the electorate. That populist renaissance had begun on the Republican side, with the rise of the Tea Party in 2009. Those anti-Washington shock troops had disrupted the town hall meetings of Democratic lawmakers pushing Obamacare, nominated small government Republicans in primaries in 2010, and provided the boost for the GOP to take control of the House in that year's midterm elections. They were mirrored on the Democratic side by the Occupy Wall Street movement, which had failed to achieve its goals not because of a lack of passion, but because of organizational weaknesses, and because the left had less appetite for destruction with a Democratic president in office. The public's anger with Washington had built steadily over the intervening years, but it was divided. Conservatives believed the government had grown too powerful and redistributed too much money from taxpayers. On the left, voters often viewed the existing government as an impediment to greater redistribution of wealth and more benefits for the middle and lower classes. However, these two sets of populists did overlap in a few essential areas. They were mad about corporate subsidies, trade agreements, and American military intervention overseas. They scapegoated different segments of society, immigrants on the right and bankers on the left, for example, but agreed that the Washington establishment, in which Hillary and many of the 17 Republican presidential candidates were major players, wasn't serving the country well. Bernie felt that way too. So while no one in Washington was paying attention to Sanders in April 2014, the tinder for an anti-Hillary outsider was spread across the country, just waiting to be lit. After leaving Bernie's office, Kress got to work immediately. He planned a dinner at his Capitol Hill home, an elegant townhouse an easy walk away from the cramped 900-square-foot, two-floor row house Sanders had bought for nearly $500,000 after winning his first six-year Senate term in 2006. As Press called around, he found that it was difficult to assemble a crew to even meet with Sanders. He asked Democrats whether they would come to an off-the-record gathering, just to hear Sanders's ideas. No commitment necessary or expected, he said. But few heeded his call. There were still people who would not come because they were already supporting Hillary, and there were people who would not come because they were afraid Hillary would find out, said a source familiar with the effort. In the end, it was a very small circle that gathered at Press's house on April 9th, 2014, a full year before Hillary announced her campaign. Sanders and Press, their wives, Jane and Carol, Sanders' press aide Michael Briggs, Democratic strategist Peter Fenn, Susan McHugh, former chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, and Democratic campaign operatives Tad Devine and Mark Longabaugh. Brad Woodhouse, who would go on to run a super PAC supporting Clinton, was also in attendance. The group was large enough that Carol Press served beef stew in the living room rather than around the dining room table, and Sanders made a pitch very similar to the one he had given Bill Press at their lunch meeting a few weeks earlier. Then he polled the room, seeking input on the various aspects of a campaign and whether he should run, and how he should do it if he did. McHugh, who ran a super PAC, asked if Bernie might create one. Devine thought that was a terrible idea because it was so off-brand for a political reformer. No one told Sanders he shouldn't run, but there was a consensus in the room. He'd have to run in the Democratic Party. That wasn't an easy pill for Sanders to swallow. He had studiously avoided association with the party, caucusing with House and Senate Democrats to secure seats on committees in Congress, but never calling himself a Democrat or doing all but the most perfunctory of fundraising for the party. Sanders wasn't sold on the idea of becoming a Democrat yet. It would mean sacrificing a major piece of his identity. 6 months later, in mid-October, a former two-time summer intern in Sanders's House office was on her way to speak at family weekend at the University of Vermont in Burlington when she ran into the man who had hired her, Sanders's state director, Phil Fiermonti. This former intern now sat on the board of UVM Honors College, but she was better known as a longtime fundraiser, scheduler, and troubleshooter for President Barack Obama. Over the course of two decades, Alyssa Mastromonaco, a petite brunette so obsessively organized that she set calendar reminders to take her vitamins, had risen through the ranks from intern for the fringe socialist congressman to deputy chief of staff at the White House. When people wanted to see Obama in the Oval Office, they had to talk to her first. Mastromonaco, an operative on John Kerry's 2004 campaign and Obama's 2008 bid, was one of Sanders's few connections to the big leagues of presidential politics, and he wanted to get her counsel. "Bernie is going to be here tomorrow," Fiermonti told Mastromonaco. "He'd like to see you." And that's how one of Obama's most trusted aides found herself in a 90-minute meeting with the man trying to foment a national political revolution from tiny Burlington. Seated in the senator's office the next day, Mastromonaco listened to her former boss talk about the prospect of running. "I'm not sure about this," Sanders confided. "A lot of people have told me I should run." "You should only do it if your heart is in it," she replied, "and you shouldn't do it as an issue candidate." Sanders was worried about whether there was a lane for him to run in. After all, Clinton had already sucked up a lot of the political oxygen in Democratic circles. "Do you think there's a place for me?" he asked. "I think there's a place for everybody," she said. "I don't think it's good for Democrats if there's no challenge during the primaries." While Mastromonaco saw Sanders as a primary challenger to Clinton, Sanders told her he still wasn't sure that was the route he wanted to take. He had been elected time and again as an independent, and he'd been critical of both parties on the campaign trail and in Congress. Becoming a Democrat was no small matter for him. "I don't see how you could do it any other way," she counseled. She knew he'd get no traction running outside the two-party system. "If you want to be a real outsider, where's the stage?" she asked. What she meant was that Sanders wouldn't get coverage from the media and wouldn't be invited to participate in presidential debates. If he ran as an independent, she knew, no one would hear him. Sanders also wanted to know about the rigors of the campaign trail and what had made the difference between the losing 2004 Kerry campaign and the winning Obama bid in 2008. It was interesting, Mastromonaco thought, that Sanders really didn't know what it was like to be on a presidential campaign. Most candidates have some familiarity because they've run before, been vetted for vice president, or even served as a high-level surrogate. Not Sanders. This was all new to him. The most valuable insight Mastromonaco shared with Sanders was the difference between the party regular candidacy of Kerry and the Fresh Outsider campaign of Barack Obama. Kerry's status as a Democratic insider both helped and hurt. It brought him institutional support, but it also meant there were a lot of people in his ear about how he should run his campaign. He was always convinced that he was missing one key staffer who could solve all of his problems. If someone told Kerry something he didn't want to hear, he would find someone else who would rubber stamp his opinion. Obama, with the help of advisors David Plouffe and David Axelrod, built a cohesive team that was neither beholden to nor heavily influenced by Democratic Party insiders. They would rise and fall together, unfearful of missing out on the advice of party stalwarts. Whenever Hillary Clinton got an endorsement in 2007, Mastromonaco told Sanders, Plouffe's invariable response was, "We don't give a fuck. Stay focused. It doesn't matter." The lesson for Sanders in 2016 was clear. For every Democratic politician who endorsed Hillary, and for every major donor who wrote her checks, there was a debt to be paid. Bernie could run without that baggage. Beholden only to his supporters, he could be more agile and more pure than Hillary. He could be like Obama. Bernie took it all in. Then he asked Mastro Monaco the most dangerous question in all of left-wing politics. Will you come to the next meeting? When Sanders's tiny band of rebels reconvened at Press's townhouse a few weeks later, on November 19th, 2014, it had grown a little bit. Mastro Monaco, who was starting a job as chief operating officer of Vice Media, came to give counsel. So did Representatives Keith Ellison of Minnesota and Barbara Lee of California, leaders of the Congressional Progressive Caucus that Sanders had founded in his first term in the House. Sanders's Senate Chief of Staff, Michaeline Crowell, who had a legendary distaste for Hillary, scribbled notes on a pad. For several others, including Devine and McHugh, it was a return engagement. This time, Carol Press made chicken cacciatore, and C-SPAN played in the background as Sanders's kitchen cabinet grew more serious about plotting an insurgent campaign for the presidency. Devine, who had counted delegates for Jimmy Carter in 1980 and worked on presidential campaigns for a long string of Democratic candidates not named Clinton, delivered a presentation on the race. He believed that if Bernie could design a dream primary system suited to his strengths, he couldn't do much better than starting with Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states on the calendar. Bernie knew agricultural and environmental issues, which mattered to Iowa and New Hampshire voters, as well as anyone. The demographics, nearly all white and not very wealthy, fit him too. Moreover, Iowa Democrats were dovish, and New Hampshire voters had shown an affinity for presidential candidates from neighboring states. "Senator," Longabaugh piped in, "I actually think you can win the New Hampshire primary." Not knowing at that point how many candidates would enter the race, Devine emphasized the importance of the first two states in winnowing the primary field and in creating momentum for the eventual winner. To compete against Hillary, though, Bernie would have to raise $40 million to $50 million before he got to New Hampshire, Devine said. This sounded like quite a lot of money to the penurious Sanders. He didn't understand why he'd need to hire press secretaries in each of the states instead of just one for the whole campaign. Devine laid out more of the challenges that Bernie would have to overcome. Hillary would have advantages at every turn, including her monster fundraising network, her existing relationships with superdelegates who would have votes at the convention, and the institutional power of a Democratic Party to which Bernie did not yet belong. If the first meeting was a toe in the water for Sanders, he was now up to his hips in the chilling and soon-to-be-turbulent tides of a presidential campaign. Sitting next to McHugh, a cold-eyed, warm-hearted political mercenary, Mastro Monaco spoke up to warn Sanders about the rigors of hitting up donors for money. "Fundraising is so hard," she said. Mastro Monaco knew what she was talking about. She'd worked on Hope Fund, the revolutionary Obama political action committee that had laid the groundwork for his buck-raking by helping other Senate candidates collect cash and then raiding their donor lists. Altogether, Mastro Monaco told Sanders, Hope Fund had built a list of 15,000 to 20,000 donors in a set of states where there had been competitive Senate races. That wouldn't be enough this time around, she argued. But it would turn out that Mastro Monaco had vastly underestimated her former boss. After listening to everyone, Sanders spoke up. He emphasized that his goal would be to seize enough attention and support to set the agenda for the Democratic primary. "Still," he said, "I haven't made up my mind." That could be a fatal error, Press thought. It would be a mistake, he warned Bernie, to let Clinton jump into the race first. And as Democratic insiders knew in those days right after the midterm debacle, she was being advised to get out of the blocks early. Sanders risked a failure to launch if he waited too long. Bernie, you've got 3 weeks, Press told him. Get in now, before the calendar turned to 2015. Sanders wasn't ready, but he wanted to know which of his allies were committed. If I decide to go, are you with me? He asked. Then he went around the room. Yes, 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 came the replies. Everyone was with him. Over the holidays, Sanders became more certain about his run, and on January 26, 2015, Guy Cecil, who had lost out to Mook in the Clinton campaign manager sweepstakes, sent a flash message to Brooklyn. Just an FYI that Sanders is calling around to interview campaign managers. Bernie's small crew may have been loyal, but he didn't have a rainmaker. Not many professional political operatives had an appetite for getting in a fight with Hillary Clinton. So Sanders hired a longtime loyalist, Jeff Weaver, who was running a comic book and video game shop in the Washington suburbs. Weaver, bald with a clean-cropped white beard and square black-rimmed glasses, was a student activist type, now nearing 50. He had graduated from driving Sanders in the 1986 gubernatorial campaign to managing his 2006 Senate bid, and he'd served as Sanders' chief of staff on Capitol Hill. While political operatives had climbed all over one another to run Hillary's campaign, Sanders was left with the most willing choice. By late April 2015, Bernie Sanders was almost ready to launch. Hillary had just jumped into the race with a weekend video release, and he could no longer afford to wait if he hoped to stop her coronation. Sanders had been planning this moment for more than a year, and perhaps, in his midnight confessions, for a lifetime. But he wasn't really prepared for a presidential run in the traditional sense. He had heart and a vision for America that, like Donald Trump's, couldn't be realized without stoking revolutionary sentiment in the electorate. Few thought that popular frustration with Washington meant that voters would turn to a candidate with virtually no experience making deals in the nation's capital. Most of Hillary's consultants and advisors didn't take Bernie as a serious threat. He had no money, he had no organization, he had virtually no support inside the political establishment. He didn't even have a place to make an announcement. Mook was overheard at one meeting saying he wasn't sure whether he'd rather have Bernie in the race, which could give Hillary a workout before the general election, or not. But Hillary recognized early on that he could catch fire and cause her heartburn. He's going to be a bigger problem than Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor and presidential hopeful, she told an aide that spring, as she filmed a video at her home in Washington. Bernie was still trying to get his head around the meaning of a presidential campaign, both for his career and for his personal life. In mid-April, he summoned Devine to Burlington for a weekend. At his home and in local restaurants, he peppered the strategist with questions about the rigors of running. "You're going to lose your privacy," Devine said. "Things you wrote 30 or 40 years ago are going to be brought up." With a little success, Bernie would eventually get a Secret Service detail, which would further impinge on his personal liberty. And, as if Devine had to remind him, the chances of beating Hillary weren't that great. For Bernie, winning wasn't the only thing. "I'm a backbencher in Congress," he told Devine. "I want to come out of this in a better position to push the issues I care about." He wanted a higher profile in the Senate if he ran and lost. A presidential campaign, if done well, can accomplish that, Devine replied. On Wednesday, April 29th, Sanders' aide Michael Briggs called over to the Democratic National Committee to ask whether he could use a room in the janky old headquarters building a few blocks southeast of the Capitol. Sanders wanted to launch his campaign, and he'd been told that Senate rules precluded him from doing that inside the Capitol. He was in a jam, and he was hoping the DNC would help out. Mo Alethi, then the communications director for the DNC, fielded the call and took the request to the chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Florida lawmaker who pledged neutrality in the primary but was widely viewed as a Clinton ally. DNC officials believed that it wasn't appropriate to give Sanders the imprimatur of the party, or at least that was a good enough reason to turn him down. Wasserman Schultz made the decision, no. It was the first of many instances in which Wasserman Schultz's actions convinced Sanders' team that she was putting her thumb on the scale for Clinton. Anxious to get in, Sanders called a press conference for the next day on a grassy plain a few dozen yards from the Capitol. At a time when the nation's hatred for all things Washington, and particularly congressional, had neared its zenith, it would have been inconceivable for any other candidate to announce his or her campaign for the presidency from the shadow of the Capitol on a patch of grass known as the Senate Swamp. For Bernie, it was the only place available on short notice. It would be inaccurate to say that he announced with little fanfare. At the time, the 100 or so reporters, camera operators, aides, and gawkers in attendance amounted to a huge crowd for a septuagenarian whose 60s radical speaking style and socialist worldview seemed miscast for the national political stage. Bernie seemed surprised not only by the turnout, but by the sound his own voice made when he spoke into the microphones on a wood-colored podium in front of him. As he started speaking, he recoiled. "Whoa!" he exclaimed. Before he moved into the guts of what he was going to say, Sanders noted that he had to get back to the Senate for work. "We don't have an endless amount of time," he said. Then he laid out the core principle of his campaign. From his earliest days as an activist, Sanders had been angry about injustice, racial and economic. He believed the American economic system was a game rigged for the wealthy. And now, he could sense, so did many Americans in both parties and outside the political process. He wasn't altering his core philosophy to match up with the frustrations of voters. They were coming around to his way of thinking. The major issue is, how do we create an economy that works for all of our people, rather than a small number of billionaires, he said. He connected that goal to the outsize influence he believed wealthy donors have on the political process, calling for campaign finance reform and a reversal of a set of Supreme Court decisions that opened up the floodgates of soft money contributions. He mentioned climate change and student debt. And before closing, he turned to the question of how he would run his campaign. "I hate and detest these 30-second ugly negative ads," he said. "I believe that in a democracy, what elections are about are serious debates over serious issues, not political gossip, not making campaigns into soap operas. This is not the Red Sox versus the Yankees," he said. Within 5 minutes, he was done, save for taking a few questions from the press. They wanted to know about the Red Sox and the Yankees. Would he go after Clinton hard on their differences, on trade and the Iraq War? "We don't know what Hillary's stances are on all the issues," he gently chided, referring to her fence sitting on the Keystone XL pipeline and the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement that Sanders opposed. "And what about the use of military force?" "I voted against the war in Iraq," he said, distancing himself from Clinton's 2002 vote to give President George W. Bush the authority to invade. And asked whether he was in the race to push his ideas forward, he responded simply that he was in the race to win it. But the most portentous answer came after he stepped away from the podium, as Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times caught up with him. After all the years of running outside the party construct, was Sanders now a Democrat? No, he said. I'm an independent. Donald Trump's entry into the campaign, from the imposing Trump Tower, could hardly have been more different. Former Texas Agricultural Commissioner Jim Hightower once said of George H.W. Bush that he was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. Well, by that measure, Trump was born on third base and clearly thought he'd stopped there ever so briefly to drink in the roar of the crowd as he trotted home in celebration of a grand slam. The larger-than-life billionaire came to money the old-fashioned way he inherited it, but he earned his fame with a rare mastery of showmanship. And like any great showman, he knew how to make a memorable entrance. With his former model wife, Melania, at his side, Trump cascaded down an escalator into the lobby of the skyscraper bearing his name on June 16, 2015. The day before, the putative Republican frontrunner Jeb Bush had launched his campaign. Trump was determined to draw an immediate contrast with the former Florida governor, who had spoken Spanish in a video accompanying his announcement. About a minute into his own speech, Trump delivered a broadside against immigrants. "When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best," he thundered. "They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists." He rambled and railed for 45 minutes about bad trade deals, expensive wars, and an Obamacare law that he described as the big lie. Trump's rhetoric was blustery, but his message was direct. Americans are falling behind, victims of insiders who give preference to outsiders. It was nativist and xenophobic, and it struck an emotional chord with downtrodden working-class white men. The candidate who understood the id of Republican primary voters best was the man initially judged least likely to capture the GOP nomination. A real estate mogul turned reality TV star who had three marriages and a pro-wrestling appearance to his credit truly understood the Fox News audience. Trump had been itching to get into the presidential race since the early part of 2015. He placed several calls to Bill Clinton in the spring, hoping to get the former president and one-time golfing partner to offer an assessment of the race. That he wanted to win the Republican nomination and beat Bill's wife for the presidency didn't matter to either man. That he could get a hold of Bill Clinton, even though it took repeated tries, was but one indication that he was exactly the insider he would claim throughout the election that he was not. Bill finally called Trump back in late May, just a few weeks before the golden-coiffed celebrity feud impresario jumped into the race. Trump asked Bill what to expect from a presidential campaign. "It's a big challenge," the former president confided. "Your life will be laid bare." But Bill stopped short of advising Trump on whether or not to run. By that point, a call to the former president, the decision had surely been made. Trump had spent years laying the groundwork. He'd aborted potential campaigns in 2000 and 2012, helped lead the birther effort to delegitimize Obama, and spent countless hours courting high-profile media types in the run-up to his launch. Aside from the occasional golf outing, contributions Trump had made to the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's Senate campaign coffers, and the Clintons' attendance at his third wedding, Trump and Bill weren't particularly close. Their daughters, Chelsea and Ivanka, had developed a relationship over the years of running in the same Manhattan circles, but there was no reason for Trump to call Bill except to hear what the sage of the Democratic Party had to say. Bill was in the habit of dispensing political analysis to anyone who asked. At that moment, Bill Clinton didn't see Trump as a threat to win the Republican nomination or the presidency, much as he hadn't anticipated the rise of Bernie Sanders. But who would have expected a billionaire who lived at the top of a tower he'd named after himself to ride a populist wave past the Republican field? Only Trump. And yet, just 5 weeks after his announcement, Trump surpassed Bush in the Real Clear Politics average of polls for the first time, a lead he would relinquish just once when Ben Carson briefly edged past him in November 2015 on his way to the Republican nomination. Trump's ascendance fascinated the media, frustrated the other 16 Republican candidates, and dominated public and private political conversation across the country. In a way, it was a gift to Hillary. Though he took his shots at her, Trump obscured the early failings of her campaign. But it was even more of a present to Sanders, who was able to build his insurgent campaign while the full scrutiny of the national media was diverted elsewhere. Moreover, Trump's daily denunciations of international trade deals and American foreign policy echoed Sanders' message. The American electorate was angry with the political class. The recovery from the recession had been quicker for Wall Street and big corporations than for ordinary citizens. They both railed against a Washington establishment that seemed to reward political and financial insiders no matter which party was in power. Trump took advantage of the increasing power of the Tea Party by appealing to the mistrust of government ingrained in lower-income, less educated voters. He ran on nostalgia, adopting a campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again," ripped off from Ronald Reagan, and traced the decline of the country to the mid-1960s. Though he didn't mention the Johnson-era's Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, or public subsidies for housing and health care, Trump's dog whistle was just the right pitch to attract the support of white supremacists and nearly all-white crowds of